Thanks for joining us at Cults to Consciousness. This storytelling podcast is meant to be for entertainment purposes only and does not substitute for any medical advice. We may discuss triggering topics, and we ask that you make your personal mental health a priority. Lastly, the opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the host.
Being out of the cult for this long, I'm still really inhibited and really just not free. I don't feel like I'm free in my body. And I realize I still have so much programming from the cult, because when I first came out, I felt really disgusting. I felt like I was a pervert because I liked girls. And I sat with myself and I was like, why do I feel this way? It's not a perversion. I am not a pervert. I'm not some bad, dirty, gross person because I happen to love the same gender.
Yeah.
But all that like internalized shame and homophobia came up within me that I didn't even know was in me. It's super interesting, like, to have that moment when something comes up in you that you would bet money on was not within you. My whole life I had to be silent. I was forced to be silent. I was forced to hide. And I don't want to hide anymore. I don't want to be silent anymore. I don't have to.
Hey, my name is Shalise Ansola, and this is Cults to Consciousness, where we discuss leaving high-demand religions or organizations and finding healing and independence through awareness and true individual sovereignty. If you're only listening and you would like to see our faces, you can go to our YouTube channel at Cults to Consciousness, where you can like, subscribe, become an advocate for these people who are bravely coming on and sharing their stories. Leaving those words of encouragement really helps us, it helps the algorithm, and it's meaningful to our guests. So today's guest, we just recently had her on. We ended up talking for 2 hours, so we decided to split it into two parts. In the first part, we go over her childhood in the IBLP, the Institute in Basic Life Principles, which is essentially a Christian fundamentalist group. Very patriarchal. There's a lot of problematic things that we go over in her childhood, as well as talking about her experience at one of the camps, how this led to eating disorders, self-harm. And in this episode, we're going to continue on with her story, talking about what happened when she finally got home from the camps, her parents' reaction, how it further led to other eating disorders, and how all of those programmings and the culture of the IBLP permeated into her adult life and is still affecting her now. We're going to be talking about how she became an exotic dancer, how she uncovered her sexuality as understanding that she was actually gay, and how she was able to deprogram from different things in her past. So here's the next part with Oceana.
Growing up, like, I always just dealt with things on my own. And it's not like I remember ever being like taught to do that. I think that was just kind of the culture and the environment. It just fostered, you know, hiding your problems and trying to deal with everything on your own. Because, yeah, there was a lot of things I dealt with growing up, a lot of things I had anxiety over, and I never told anyone. It didn't even cross my mind. Maybe I should tell someone. Maybe I should ask for help. It wasn't even an option. It wasn't even a thought in my brain. It was just, this sucks. I hate this, but I just have to deal with it, and I can't wait for it to be over. Like, there were years, years and years and years of night terrors where I was terrified to go to sleep at night, and I really didn't ever say anything. Like, my parents found out because I would wake up, or they would wake up to me screaming. It just was kind of laughed off, like, oh, Anna was screaming last night. Oh, haha, like, she was doing that weird thing again. Like, it just was brushed off. These things that, to me, as an adult, I feel like are very obvious signs that, like, something's going on. Your kid's not okay. Something's happening to them. Like,
right.
You should look into it. The signs are all there.
Right.
But again, you know, if you're sleep deprived and you have so many children that you can't take care of and you're just overwhelmed, like, of course, you can't handle it all and you're going to miss a lot of things, I'm sure.
Well, especially if mental health is not acknowledged or recognized in any sort of way. It doesn't seem like they or you had the tools to even put words to how you were feeling. I think there's been such a huge influx of awareness around mental health in the past 10 years or so, where all of us millennials are going, oh, that's something we need to take care of just as much as our physical health. And people are normalizing therapy now. And it's so great that we can start to unwind our traumas and dig into them and figure out how to heal them and find peace. But I think back then, especially in a group like that where they're demonizing therapy, there's really no language to express or address what's going on with you, what's going on with your kids, for example. So I imagine that that was really something that wasn't even a thought, like you were just mentioning. I didn't even know there was an option to get help. But I have to think that when you came home from that training center, it should have been blatantly obvious that something was going on with you. Did your parents ever see the scars? Did they recognize that you were going through a really difficult time at that point?
Yeah, I know my dad did see the cut marks on me at one point because he confronted me about it. And I was really like a bit embarrassed and ashamed, and I wouldn't show him. I was like, Dad, please, like, no, like, don't make me show you your wrist. Like, you know what's there. They knew it was going on. I think they really didn't know how to handle it. And with the eating stuff, they didn't know how to handle it either. They tried. They did what they knew to do. I'm sure they prayed about it a lot. My mom knew a lady at church whose daughter had eating disorder, so she talked to her for advice. So they were doing like the little things that they did know to do. They would monitor my food. They would tell me to eat more, try to get me to eat more. And then they were weighing me as well. And then later when it morphed from the anorexia, the orthorexia, the exercise addiction, when it more so morphed from that into bulimia and binge eating, then I started gaining weight and they were still weighing me so they could see the weight gain. And then I got shamed a little bit.
Oh no.
For being, I guess, heavier than I should have been, than they thought I should be at that point. And looking back, it was a normal weight, completely normal, yeah. Completely healthy. I think I just maybe had gained too much weight over a short period of time because of the binge eating, but just the way my dad went about it, like, again, like, not to talk badly about him because I'm sure he didn't know better, but the way he confronted me about it and asked me kind of like, why is it so high? And then kind of like, I think you're a girl that likes to eat treats and this is why, like, I think you probably have gained weight because you're eating a lot of treats secretly, which I was, he was completely right. But it was so shaming and humiliating that, like, yeah, to this day, like, I can't think about it without, like, kind of cringing internally and just, oh, it almost, I don't know, kind of makes me want to cry even a little because I'm like, that's just so awful. That's like the number one way not to handle an eating disorder. Like, never shame anyone for the behaviors that they're doing.
Yeah.
But yeah, they did what they could, I guess.
I'm sorry you dealt with that. I can only imagine what that must have been like for you, going from one extreme to the other and not getting any sort of real therapy or help for it and not really having anyone to turn to, especially if your own parents are kind of on the, it's like this teeter-totter back and forth of, okay, well, if you don't want me to eat, now I'm eating too much. Like, what do you want from me? Where is this happy middle ground? How do I find it? That seems really, really difficult to navigate. Is that something that you've had to deal with over the years? Or at any point, did you find healing from that?
Yeah. It's something I've dealt with my entire adult life. I think the eating disorder was probably the worst in my 20s. It completely consumed my life. I would pretty much just get up and go to work every day and just try to make it through the day. I wouldn't eat all day. I was afraid of like having like digestive issues if I did eat something. But also I was too afraid to eat in front of my coworkers. Like, I was very, very shameful around food. Even to this day, I don't love being watched when I eat, but it was really extreme back then, where now if someone is watching me and I'm eating, I'll be uncomfortable, but I'll push through it and I'll eat. Whereas before I wouldn't eat. I would just be like, okay, I'm done. I can't physically eat. I can't do this. But yeah, I was definitely the worst in my 20s. I would come home and then I would try my hardest not to eat throughout the evening. I eventually would cave because, you know, you haven't eaten all day. And then I would binge because my body is so hungry at that point and is overcompensating for the fast all day long. So I would just, I physically felt like I couldn't stop. Like, I felt like it was like a monster inside of me, ravenous and out of control, that I couldn't stop even if I tried, even if I wanted to. And I really did want to, and I tried so much. And then, of course, the guilt. So then that's when the purging would take place after. I would abuse laxatives since I couldn't throw up. I tried and was not successful. So I was like, all right, I'll use laxatives, I guess. That's better than nothing. Like, I have to get it out of me. I'm so uncomfortable and so guilty feeling at this point. So then I would take laxatives and be up all night. So I have insomnia to begin with. I've always had sleeping issues. So really wasn't sleeping much, wasn't sleeping well, especially when I was abusing laxatives, wake up, I'd get up and do it all over again. So very, again, even though at that point in my 20s, I was out of the cult, I still was very sheltered and very isolated because of my mental health mm-hmm. issues at that point. So yeah, that was kind of my life, my entire 20s up until like the very end. And then the end of my 20s is when finally things started to get a little bit better. I don't think they'll ever fully get better. I don't think I'll ever fully recover from an eating disorder. I think I'll always have to kind of keep an eye on it and have those thoughts in the back of my mind. But it's significantly better now. Yeah, ironically, this is my story and my truth, but I'm not recommending this. How my eating disorder started to get better was I did discover weed, and I would smoke it at night to help me sleep because I had such severe insomnia and sleeping issues, and like melatonin didn't work, like nothing would help me. So I would smoke weed because that was the one thing that could get me to sleep. But then I would be so tired that I physically didn't have the energy to go in the kitchen and binge. Mm. So that's what kind of helped me stop binging. And when I was stopped binging and stopped abusing laxatives, that's when I started to be able to eat more healthy and more normal. And if I didn't binge the night before, I can wake up and eat breakfast, no problem. I'm not still full. I'm not uncomfortable. I'm not having digestive issues or anything like that. So I could eat. And so slowly over time, it took me years, honestly, I started trying to eat more and more throughout the day. And that helped me a lot when my eating started to kind of balance out and normalize a little bit more. Like I said, I do still struggle with it, but it's a lot better. I don't think about it very often. I did have a slip up recently over the holidays, but it was the first slip up in like a year, if not longer. So to me, I'm very happy with that and that progress.
Yeah.
But it's still there, of course, somewhat.
Well, thank you for sharing that and being vulnerable and so raw, because I think a lot of people are going to be able to watch this and relate to your story. And it is so powerful when we can be open and vulnerable about our stories. So I really appreciate you sharing that. I know we wanted to talk about your life after the cult, and there was something that happened where your family actually left together when you were a teen. I don't know how much time you want to spend around that, because I do want to get to the next part of your story, but however much you want to share about how and why your family left.
How we left is somewhat of a mystery to me, a little bit, somewhat, just because my parents have never talked about it to me before. And the few occasions that I have myself gone to them and asked them questions specifically about the cult, they're very vague, they're very evasive. To this day, they will not call it a cult, even though I know that they know it's a cult. They have to, but they'll never actually admit that. So talking to them is very uncomfortable to begin with. It's very difficult to do. I don't usually get straight answers. So I'm not entirely sure what the leaving process entailed entirely, but it was kind of gradual over time. I do know that much. My oldest brother, he attended the college that the cult created. They had their own college too, of course. And I think it was Verity something. So I assume it was like Verity Institute or something like that. But my oldest brother went there. And when he was there, he had an experience, which I'm not going to go into because that's his story and I don't have his permission to share it. So I won't like give any details or anything like that. But he had a particular experience that was not the greatest. So he had an experience, and like Bill Gothard told him to handle it a certain way and told my family to handle it a certain way, because we were coming for my brother's graduation at the very end. And Bill Gothard literally called my dad and was like, you know, this is what's going on. This is how you are to handle it when you come here. And my dad got off the phone. He sat us all down for a family meeting. He was like, Bill Gothard called, you know, this is what's going on. This is how he told us to handle it. And we are not going to do that. He was like, we're going to do exactly what we would do normally. We're going to go there and act normal like we normally would. We're not going to follow these rules because we think that's absolutely ridiculous. So we went and we did. To my knowledge, no, like nothing bad happened. Like no drama ensued that I know of. But obviously I could also just not be aware of it because I was quite young at that time. But I think that's when the cracks started to show a little bit. And then when they really started to show was when my younger sister went to the Journey to the Heart retreat that they put on. And Bill Gothard wanted her to come live at headquarters with him and work for him. So I think it looks, you know, based off what it looks like Bill Gothard was trying to get her to come and be a Gothard girl. And for those that don't know, the Gothard girls were the attractive, oftentimes troubled young women that Bill Gothard would like hand select mm-hmm. and try to convince to come live at headquarters and work for him. And then not only would he have them overworking for him, but he also then was grooming them, and then he did things to them. And all that information is online, the court cases and everything, if you want to learn more about yeah. that. But it seems like he was trying to get my sister to become a Gothard girl. And when Bill called my dad with my sister there on speakerphone and was like, hey, she wants to come do this, you know, she's agreed, and I think this would be great for her. I think the alarm bells went off in his head. I think as a man, like maybe he picked up on some creepiness, something about it didn't feel right to him. So my dad was like, no, absolutely not. And then he told my mom, he was like, we're going to go get her. He sent my mom and one of my siblings to go get her from headquarters or the training center, wherever she was at. And they brought her home. And my dad was like, no, that's definitely not happening. My sister was really upset at the time. In hindsight now, of course, like she's very grateful that that did not actually happen. But it was shortly after that that I think we officially left the cult. But again, I don't know when exactly. I don't know what that process looked like. I don't know if my parents experienced a lot of backlash or shunning. Like, I have no idea what that experience was like for them. I would be really curious to find out, actually. But it's not something they've ever discussed with me, and it's not something I think that they ever would be really open to talking about.
Sure.
Maybe someday, but...
How old were you at this point?
So it was, like, right before I went to college. So I think I might have been, like, around the age of 17, maybe.
Okay, so it wouldn't have affected your home life, because at that point you were moving out and you could do your own thing.
Yeah, it was around the time when I was gaining a lot more independence. Yeah, for sure.
Okay. So you're out on your own. You are discovering who you are. You are forging your own path and also dealing with a lot of emotional turmoil. I know we've mentioned off camera CPTSD, trying to unravel your childhood and these traumas and things that really affected you. So where does your story go from here after you're 18 years old and you've moved out of the house? How are you navigating this life outside of IBLP? Because also we mentioned the homeschooling thing. You were very insulated and isolated within this community. Are you starting to mess with modesty? Are you starting to wear pants? Are you starting to figure out who you are? And what does that look like?
Yeah, like my 20s, the majority of my 20s, I was still like very sheltered, very isolated, just due to the eating disorder, the mental health issues. I've always had severe anxiety and depression as well. And then unknowingly at that time, having CPTSD and being misdiagnosed with other things. So it was very, very sheltered. It wasn't until my later 20s that I started to, I feel like, kind of find myself more. I mean, obviously, even being sheltered in my 20s, that was a process in and of itself too, in finding myself and my voice and my truth. But really towards the end of my 20s, I feel like I've kind of settled into this place where I'm much more open-minded. I'm much more open to life, and I'm trying a lot of new things. I think I started part-time dancing in an adult nightclub, probably towards the end of my 20s again, maybe mid-20s. Just did that very briefly on and off. And now it's something I do more full-time. But I think that was definitely a huge part of finding myself after being in this cult that strips women of any power, any authority, any leadership, and that really keeps them small
yeah.
and teaches them to cover up and hide. For me, I found that being exposed and being in this type of environment and dancing and, I guess, you know, technically like being paid to take off my clothes, I found it to be very empowering. And also from an eating disorder standpoint, just being so ashamed of my body, because even when I was deep in the eating disorder, I would wear like very baggy clothes to hide my body. I was very, very ashamed of what I looked like. I think being in that type of environment and becoming an exotic dancer really helped me find myself. It's helping teach me boundaries and dealing with people, men in particular, that try to cross those boundaries. It taught me super valuable, important social skills. Honestly, I credit stripping to really helping me come out of my shell. I'm still naturally shy and introverted and more on the quiet side. I don't love attention, but in the club, when I'm on stage, that's like one of the few times where I don't mind being the center of attention. Mm. And it's kind of nice to be on that side of things. And in the club, I'm a very different person. I'm very outgoing. I'm very talkative, because you have to be. And it is a performance, to some extent, but it did teach me really valuable social skills. It taught me how to do small talk. Small talk was something I had no idea how to do before, which probably seems like the easiest, most natural thing in the world for so many people. But for me, it was just like, I don't know how to do it and I hate it and I don't want to do it. So I would just sit there really like small and quiet and awkward. I've been in therapy. I'm going to get back into therapy again soon, just because I am realizing as I go through life and as things pop up, I'm realizing how much growing up in this cult affected me and still affects me to this day, where I still have programming and I still have these thoughts and memories that come back from it. The night terrors have gotten significantly better. I still will have sleeping issues and insomnia, but the night terrors have gone away. The nightmares, they still continue to this day, and they'll kind of come and go with the intensity and the frequency that they happen. But I think I'm definitely in a much healthier, better place after having gotten some therapy. I think it's pretty clear to me that I still need a lot of therapy. So I'm excited to go back to therapy and just continue to heal and grow and evolve. I'm trying to learn how to come out of my shell more. That's kind of the challenge I'm facing right now, because I'm still, even after being out of the cult for this long, I'm still really inhibited and really just not free. I don't feel like I'm free in my body, because I go to things like I just went to this really fun drag brunch, and I would love to be singing along to the songs and I would love to be dancing in my chair, but there's something that keeps me down that won't let me be free and expressive and dance and sing. It's getting better. Like, I'm getting a little bit better, very small, in very small increments, but that's something I still do struggle with. I think meditation has helped me come really, really far. That's actually was life-saving to me when I was having panic attacks last year for the first time ever, and like truly thought I was going to die. Meditation was the only thing that could help me. Meditation was the only thing that could pull me up out of this intense, intense darkness and depression. Yeah. Not to sound like my dad, like, oh, just meditate and you'll be fine. Just read the Bible and you'll be fine. But I do think there's something really powerful about meditation. And I think if I looked into it, the science behind it, I think would correlate to that feeling.
Yeah. Can I jump in real quick? Because there's so much there.
Absolutely.
There's so much to dissect of what you just were talking about. So first of all, I love that you have embraced your sexuality, and if stripping feels good to you and it feels empowering and it feels amazing, I love that you're doing that for yourself and setting those boundaries and learning how to embody sexuality, because it's so relatable. As you were talking, you're like, yeah, I'm more quiet and timid, but when I go in there, it's like, this is my stage. This is my space to come out of my shell. And that's exactly how I was and still am with dancing. That was my safe space growing up, was being able to perform and be on stage. And otherwise, it was just, I'm very quiet. No one's really going to listen to me. I also suffered from child sexual abuse. And so I think it was the be quiet and just be silent and no one's going to hear you, or don't say anything and all of that. And so it culminated into this personality, especially with Mormonism, of women should be seen and not heard. Be quiet. Yes, you're important, but don't talk too loud. And so really just embracing sexuality and embracing one's body through dance is so beautiful. And I still do that now, like with salsa dancing. When I go to salsa, well, not right now because I'm super pregnant, but when I would go to salsa dancing clubs, I love being sexy and I love performing and I love the attention. I'm not afraid to say that. I think it's fun to be able to embrace myself and my body in a way that feels good to me. And it may not feel good to other people, and they don't have to do that. And that's the beauty of it, is you don't have to be a stripper to find your sexuality. But if you want to be a stripper to find your sexuality, go for it. If that's what works for you, if that's what makes you feel embodied and powerful, if that's what reconnects you to your sexuality, because that's what happens in these cults, is they hypersexualize you so much that you're forced to disconnect from yourself completely. You're forced to not even see yourself as a sexual being, because if you do, then you're playing into the whole, I'm being too sexy and they're gonna lust after me, or if something happens to me, if I'm assaulted, it's my fault. It's this really confusing place to be. And so I just love that you found something that really helps you embody yourself and helps you I guess just find who you are. And I know we're going to get into sexuality stuff after this or a little bit later, but I just wanted to say that, first of all, I think that's great. And also with the meditation side, I think it is different than prayer. I know they can be kind of interchangeable as far as religious goes or spirituality goes, and they kind of are the same as far as making a wish to the universe or asking God for something. But when it does come down to meditation, it's really just about stillness. It's about inner peace. It's about awareness. It's a way to look inside for the answers. It's a way to notice what's going on in your body instead of projecting onto some sort of deity or asking for something outside of yourself. Would you say that's a fair assessment of what you experience with meditation and why it's helpful?
Yeah. And I really like the way you put that, how it's like looking within yourself instead of like to some outside deity, because it is all about like finding that peace and that stillness and that light. That's something I've really worked to connect with, is my inner light and my inner magic, after being taught that it's wicked and sinful to look within yourself. Right. And there's some Bible verse even like that we would have quoted at us, you know, the heart is like desperately wicked above all else, who can trust it, or something like that. And the overall like just feeling with this cult is that they try to dim your light and they try to steal your magic and erase it and wipe it away and paint it as dark and evil and sinful. And so meditation has really helped me reclaim that. Like, I will literally sit and meditate with the intention of connecting to my inner magic, to my inner spark, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
In addition to like finding the peace and the stillness and all that, which is so healthy for you, not just mentally and emotionally, but also physically. It's just healthy and good for your body.
Yeah, I agree. So is this a good time to then talk about your sexual awakening, or really coming into yourself and finding who you are?
Yeah, definitely. Because yeah, right around the end of my 20s is when I really feel like I found myself. Up until then, my entire life, I really truly believed that I was straight. And I think I was straight, I think, but I don't know. I don't know for sure, because within this culture, sexuality is so repressed, and homosexuality is like, that's not even an option. It's it's save yourself completely until marriage and then get married. And it's one man, one woman, no other genders, no other orientations, nothing. All of that is sinful, perversion, unnatural. So like, it wasn't even an option. Like, I didn't ever, and this is also why I'm not sure if I was born gay or not, because a lot of people that are born gay, they know it from the start, or they have like crushes on friends or female teachers and things like that. I never did. I was all about boys. That just didn't even cross my mind. I never had any interest when I got older in experimenting with women, nothing. So I don't know. I don't know if I was born gay or not. And the switch like happened later in life. I don't know if maybe it was super repressed in me, if I would have either known sooner or realized that part of me sooner, if it had been an option, if it had been something. It just wasn't even on my radar. Like, I knew it was out there when I got a little older, but I knew it was sin and it was perversion and unnatural. And I just didn't think I would have any interest in women. But the older I got, I think the more open-minded I became. And I think I realized at one point, I was with the man that I was engaged to for a little bit. We were together. At the end there was a point where one of his friends actually realized they were trans, or maybe knew all along that they were trans, but decided to come out as trans and live their authentic self and transition from male to female. And what happened with this friend was their marriage, because this woman at the time was a man married to another woman, their marriage dissolved because of that. And I just remember looking at my boyfriend and telling him, you know, like, I'm super straight. I don't think I could ever like, it's just not in me to be gay. Like, I have no interest in women. I have no interest whatsoever. But I looked at him and I was like, I know you're never going to transition. I know, like, that's not you. But it just was a realization, a self-realization for me that, like, if this person did transition, I would still love them. And I was like, oh, wow. So what does that say about me? Like, I don't think I'm not gay. I don't think I'm into women. But when you love someone, you just love them. It doesn't matter the exterior. So that's when I started to, like, that's when I feel like I first became open to the idea. And then even later on, I realized, like, I don't think like women are would do it for me. I'm really super not into that. I have no interest in experimenting. But if I did happen to find a woman and fall in love with her, like, I wouldn't limit myself. I wouldn't like not pursue it because I feel like I'm so straight. You know, I would love who I love. So that was like kind of the beginning of my mind expansion or mind opening, where I was like, okay, I'm open to this. I don't think I want that for myself. I don't think I'd ever go that way, but I'm open-minded enough where I wouldn't reject it if it happened, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Which then, ironically, a few years later, at the very, very end of my 20s, I did meet a female-bodied person at work one night, and they were interested in me. And long story short, I did end up dating them. We were together for a couple years. That was the first female-bodied person I had ever been with. And after being with that person, I realized, like, I'm actually really gay. Like, I don't know why I thought I was so straight, because I could never go back and date a man at this point. It just, I couldn't do it. Like, once, now that I'm on this side of things, now that I've experienced being with a woman, like, I could never settle for a man. Like, it just, it wouldn't feel right to me at this point. It just, it feels unnatural. It would feel traumatic, and I would feel so dead inside being with a man, because that's just, it's not right for me. I just, the same level of connection, the same spiritual connection, I just, it wouldn't be there. You know, I've dated men for a long time. I have a lot of experience with men. I work with men. You know, every single night I am with men, and I see the best and the worst of them. And I see the worst sides of them. And I see who men are underneath it all. Because a lot of men, due to society, will not do things that they otherwise would if they either were alone and guaranteed that they would never be caught, or if society was more accepting of men being more predatory. I think society is like hopefully slowly getting a little better in that regard. But I just see this side of men that also I'm just like, wow, they really kind of feel like a different species. They're very different. Their brains are different. Like, I could not feel safe with a man. And I don't think I could feel spiritually connected to a man at this point. So
that's really interesting. And I'm not an expert, so everything that I'm about to say, like, we could just throw it all out if we want to. But if I were to analyze this, I think it is really likely and really plausible that you were born this way. And I do want to say, just for the record, I do believe people are born gay, because I know there's a lot of people who say it's a choice or it's a lifestyle, and I just don't agree with that. But I do think that it's very, very possible that this has been buried in you all along. And because of the programming, because of the demonization of being gay, because of the hypersexualization of women, because of the repression, I think it's something that could have just been buried, and you're just now, or you were just then, discovering, wow, this is what love is supposed to feel like. I mean, we've had people on here. We had two women who grew up Mormon. They were in, according to Mormon, quote, regular marriages with men. And then they met each other and realized, oh my gosh, we are so gay for each other. They had no idea that they were gay. And they were like, yeah, growing up, I just thought, wow, I'm so righteous and God is blessing me without these sexual urges to want to be with men. And they really didn't recognize it until they were with each other and they were with a woman. And now they're happily married and they've blended their families. It's a whole thing. So I think it's possible, and I've seen it happen before, where you may think you like something, but then you get the opposite and you go, oh, this is what it's supposed to feel like. This is what my heart has been looking for. This is what my body has been craving. And I think even the same can be said for straight people, you know, having sexual experiences. And then when you meet your person, going, oh, this is what it's supposed to be like. All those other sexual experiences were fine. Yeah, but this is what love really feels like. And that's, I hope that came across well, because that's not to say that people who are gay, like, oh, just go have sex with someone else and you're going to like it. I know that sexuality is a spectrum, but that's just my two cents. And I feel like with everything that you've told us, it really makes sense to me that that's something that just emerged at a time when you were finally physically safe, you were having better experiences mentally, you're coming into a safe space just all around and in general, and your body and your brain is saying, okay, now we can explore this because we're in the right headspace. What do you think about all of that?
That definitely resonates with me. I think, yeah, that definitely feels true to me that I think finally I'm at a place in my life where I've left behind so much of the mind programming and reprogrammed my mind with the help of my therapist, and just gotten to such a healthy and safe feeling place that, yeah, I think now who I am is starting to fully emerge, and things that before might not have been safe to explore now do feel,
yeah,
I do feel ready for, and they're naturally coming out. Yeah, I wish I could have realized sooner that I'm gay, but at the end of the day, I'm just grateful that now I know that about myself and that now I'm living authentically to me. And yeah, I'm very grateful for the person that I was with, the first female I was ever with. I'm very grateful that they kind of helped me see that side of myself, because I was really scared to be with them initially. I was really afraid that I wasn't really gay. I was like, I'm attracted to this person. I think I might be, but I'm not for sure because I've never been with a woman before. And I remember our first kiss, I was really scared to kiss them because I was afraid that I was mistaken. Like, I couldn't even trust my own self at that point. I think I've grown a little bit more in that area where I do trust myself more, and I'm learning even more and more to trust my intuition. But at the time, I thought, I'm going to kiss them. I'm going to be disgusted. I'm going to realize, like, I'm really, really straight. I'm actually not gay. I'm going to hurt their feelings and they're going to take it personal. And I was just really scared about that, but I did end up going through with it and kissing them, and it was fine, more than fine, because once I had kissed them, I realized like, oh yes, I am actually really, really, really gay. Yeah. And from there, it's just been a continual journey of just continuing to open my mind and try to grow and try to heal and just become more and more of myself. But it was interesting because when I first, I guess, sort of came out, like I never officially came out, but when it was made public, when I was posting on social media and I knew that, like, everyone knew, okay, Anna is gay, it was super interesting the feelings that came up. And I realized I still have so much programming from the cult, because when I first came out, I felt really disgusting. I felt like I was a pervert because I liked girls. And I sat with myself and I was like, why do I feel this way? It's not a perversion. I am not a pervert. I'm not some bad, dirty, gross person because I happen to love the same gender.
Yeah.
But all that, like, internalized shame and homophobia came up within me that I didn't even know was in me. It's super interesting, like, to have that moment when something comes up in you that you would bet money on was not within you. Like, I was very open-minded. I was very pro-LGBTQIA. You know, I was an ally. I thought I was straight, but I still considered myself an ally. I was like, people should be able to love who they want to love. It should be legalized, all of that. So I was really surprised when, like, this internal homophobia and religious programming came up within me. But it only lasted maybe a month, and I worked through it. I don't feel that way anymore, but it's super interesting, like, just to kind of step back and be like, wow, I wonder what else is in me that I'm not aware of yet.
Yeah. And how did your family react to this news?
So, like I said, I didn't come out. How I kind of let people know is I just posted pictures of me and this person together. So it was obvious, like, we're dating. So it's obvious I'm gay because I'm with a female bodied person. I didn't call them up and say, you know, like, hey, I have something to tell you. Nothing like that. How they dealt with it, I know they're not happy about it. I know that they believe, again, that it's a sin, that it's unnatural and perversion. They kind of more so just avoid the subject. My parents in particular, they won't call the person that I'm dating my girlfriend or my partner. It's always my friend. Mm. They won't acknowledge the relationship. At first, with the previous partner I had, they wouldn't even call this person by their name. They wouldn't ask about them. They wouldn't ask about our relationship. They wouldn't talk about it. If I brought it up, they wouldn't really address it. They wouldn't really engage in the conversation beyond what they absolutely had to. So they're very weird around it. They're very uncomfortable. They're very awkward. But early on, I made the choice that I will not cater to homophobia, and I will not cater even to my family's homophobia. So they can be weird about it all they want. That's fine. That's their issue. That's a them problem. But yeah, for me, I'm proud of the people that are in my life. I'm proud of the people that I am with. So I'm going to post them. I'm going to bring them up. sometimes it's a little uncomfortable talking about it because I know that it makes my family uncomfortable. But again, you know, I refuse to cater to homophobia, so I will continue to talk about it the same as I did in the past with straight relationships. And they're starting to get a little better. My family will sometimes engage with me a little bit more when I'm talking about my partner. Recently, my mom even asked me questions about my partner, which she has never done. She still wouldn't call her my girlfriend. But she said, what does your friend like to do? Like, what are her hobbies? Mm-hmm. Like showing a little bit of interest at least. So I'm like, well, that's progress. Not perfect, but it's progress. You know, they will never be okay with it. I have almost gotten in debates about why homosexuality is a sin with my parents. But at this point, it's more so just about living my truth, not catering to toxicity, or homophobia or anything like that. But they'll probably always be a little bit weird about it, which is fine. You know, again, that's a them thing.
Yeah, I'm glad that you're standing your ground on that because you've come so far. You made so much progress. You've figured out who you are, and it's so inspiring and amazing to see how far that you've come. And so I'm glad that we're not reverting back to that submissive person, the person who just pleases everyone because they feel like they have to. It's really great to see you saying, nope, this is who I am. Take it or leave it. I'll be here if you want to talk about it. You know, it's awesome. So is there anything else that you want to share about your life now and how you're doing and what brings you peace and happiness?
I think the main things with where I'm at now, especially for other people who might be coming out of a similar situation or the same cult as me, the things that have really helped me that I would recommend and the things that are continuing to help me and give me peace and make my life better. First and foremost, therapy. I will always, always, always preach therapy, especially with someone, not just someone, of course, you know, bare minimum license credential, you know, because in the past, when I was really young, the only therapy I ever was allowed to get was going to see my pastor's wife. So getting real therapy from people that are not just credentialed, but that specialize in trauma or helping people recover that came out of cults, religious trauma, high control, religious organizations, anything like that. Just specialize in that. I highly, highly recommend. Meditation and time in nature has always really helped me. So that has helped a lot. And building community, building chosen family, people that do love you and see you fully for who you are and accept you, people that will support you. I don't have a family that I can fall back on for support, which is why I think it's extra important to be creating my own chosen family. Pets were super helpful and therapeutic for me. Yeah. Before I had community, all I had were my pets. And so my fur babies are literally my life, and they have given me so much peace and healing. I'm so lucky to have them. So I think if you can create your own family, even if it's just like a little fur family while you're trying to build community and find other people, if there's no one in your area, go online. And that's why I started my YouTube channel and talking about growing up in a cult. It's kind of triggering and it kind of feels like oversharing. Like a lot of times I'll lay in bed at night and be like, oh my God, I have to delete my channel. Like it's too much. But the whole purpose is to have a community online in a safe space where people can come to, especially if you don't have that in your real life. At least you can come online and there's other people like you and you can find solace in that and you can find that type of community. Because that was something that was super healing on my journey. When the website Recovering Grace came out, that was huge for me to hear other people that went through the same experiences as me or something similar. And I only ever was comfortable calling ATI a cult after reading some of the stories on Recovering Grace and hearing other people validate that, yes, it was a cult. Because growing up, I always thought it was kind of culty. My siblings and I amongst ourselves would kind of joke about it. Like, this is so culty. Like, we hate this. It's so culty. It's so stupid. But I never actually believed growing up that I had been in a cult. I just thought I grew up very odd and very different and like didn't have the language for it. So I think it's really important to be able to put the right language to your experiences, to call it what it is, to find that community, create that community, find the places online, because there are people that will love you and want to not just hear your story, but support you and be there for you. And the last thing I think I would say is the biggest thing you could do for yourself, the biggest rebellion against this cult and this upbringing, the most healing and therapeutic thing, that I feel like you can do is to live your life 100% as authentically as possible. Live it as big and as loud as possible. Don't stay small. That's another reason why, even though it's a little bit hard for me and it feels like very cringy at times, I am speaking out and I do have a channel on YouTube, is because my whole life I had to be silent. I was forced to be silent. I was forced to hide, and I don't want to hide anymore. I don't want to be silent anymore. I don't have to. So use your voice, even if it shakes. Live your life as fully as possible. Do all the things that you want to do that you couldn't do. For example, you know, rock music was forbidden and sinful in our cult. And I always wanted to be a drummer. I always wanted to learn to play drums. Now as an adult, that's something I can pursue and I'm working to pursue because I can and because it gives me so much joy.
Yeah.
So pursue the things that you've always wanted to do that you couldn't do, you know, even if they seem silly, even if you feel like, oh, it's too late for me, I'm too old. Like, just pursue what gives you joy. Live your life on purpose and try to find that magic again because it's still in you.
Yes.
The cult tried to erase your magic, but the cult can't. Bill Gothard can't. Religion can't. Your parents can't. It's still in you, even if you don't feel it. It might feel dead, but I promise you it is still in there and you can access it and you will find it. I promise. I found it through meditation, but that's just one of many paths that I think you can find it through. But I think that's mainly what I would say.
Yes, girl, preach. Both hands up. Yes to everything you just said. So many good golden nuggets in there. I mean, absolutely yes to the pets thing. They are so healing and just, oh, unconditional love. And for those who know Oscar Mayer, he's not here today, actually, because he's home with Jonathan. But normally he's right on my lap during every interview. Such a great emotional support. And I think we've heard Tinkerbell in the background of your videos a couple times.
Probably.
Which is awesome. Is Tinkerbell a Pomeranian? I feel like it's Pomeranian.
She's a Chihuahua. Okay. She's a little all black Chihuahua.
I knew she was small. I could tell. And with a name like Tinkerbell.
If she comes back in here, I'll show you.
Okay. Yeah, sounds good. But yeah, so many good things to pull from that. And I love how far you've come, like I've said. And all of those could have been Linda Listen moments. But do you have any other Linda Listen moments or the sassy statement that you want to say or further inspiration? It's up to you.
I think in line with what I was saying about your inner magic and your inner light, like, pursue that fearlessly, relentlessly. Just go after whatever makes you happy and whatever brings you alive, whatever speaks to your soul. We weren't free for so long. Now we finally are free. And that's it can be scary and it can be daunting experiencing the world for the first time, but if you think about it, it's also really, really exciting. Like, the whole world is open to us and it's not this big, bad, scary place like we were taught. There are people you can trust, like, obviously be careful, but it's a beautiful place that we get to live in, that we get to explore. There's so many opportunities. Like, I always say it kind of jokingly to my friends, but like, literally the world is our oyster. Like, go out and explore and live life to the fullest and find that magic again. And don't let anybody stop you. Don't let anyone keep you silent any longer.
Yes, beautiful. I agree. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story and being so open. I really appreciate all the things that you've been willing to talk with me about today.
Thank you for having me. This was very healing, and I really hope that it can help at least one person. I hope someone hears it and feels a little less alone.
Yeah.
Or has a little spark of hope or inspiration from hearing it, I hope.
Well, I'm inspired, so mission accomplished.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, of course. So guys, if you want to find Oceana, your YouTube is the handle is at Oceana333. Instagram at witchybish with 3 H's underscore. We'll put all these in the description so you can find her. And TikTok at Anna.Oceana. So people can reach out to you and see what you're up to on YouTube. And do you have any other final thoughts before we go?
Just definitely connect with me on social media, especially if you're feeling lonely, if you need an ear, someone that can relate. I am there for you and I want to be there for you. I want to help you in whatever way I can, if you need a friend or an ally.
Oh, that's so beautiful. Thank you. And guys, if you are still watching, leave those comments down below for Oceana, those words of encouragement. We love seeing those nice, heartfelt comments. It means a lot to us that we can facilitate this platform for our guests to feel loved and supported. And remember, our guests do read the comments, and so it's really helpful when you can do that, boost the algorithm, help more people find the video. And if you want to support the channel even further, you can become a patron if you'd like at patreon.com/cultstoconsciousness. You can get some of our merch. We have some Apostates Unite. I'm sorry for what I said when I was in a cult. We have some baby onesies now. This little one could come literally any day, and I got a couple onesies for her. One of them says cult free kid.
I love that.
To raise a cult free kid, or I don't want to be in your cult onesies, which are kind of fun too. So you can check that out if you'd like. If you want to come to Costa Rica with us, we have 5 spots left at the time of this recording. They are filling up. So if you're interested in doing something not culty and just fun and empowering, we will have a trauma-informed therapist coming with us to do some workshops that are really tailored toward empowerment. In fact, one of them, Oceana, is about reconnecting with your body, because so often we get disconnected from our bodies in these cults. And also, you don't have to be a cult survivor to come. You can just come hang out with us. It's more about just finding yourself and doing fun things in the rainforest. So that will be in the description as well. And if you like this video, I will leave 2 more down here below that you'll want to check out. And until next time, follow your highest excitement, be conscious, and be well. Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, it would mean a lot if you could like and subscribe on YouTube and leave a review or a comment to help with our visibility. You can also find me on social media at cults2consciousness, or reach out by email at cults2consciousness@gmail.com.